Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Okay. Welcome to the Writer's Block. I was thinking there would be another piece of music there. Welcome to the Writer's Block. I'm one of the hosts tonight, Bobby Jean Bell, and Richard Polinelli is here by my side, but we're social distancing. Go ahead, Richard, and say hello.
Yeah, we have social distance so much, I'm actually hanging out in the bunker here in Omaha, and Bobby Jean's in Albuquerque. Yeah, I was with you on that. I was waiting for Ronan to have the second song come in. I'm like, come on, Ronan.
Well, that's okay. It's live radio, and we just roll with it, right? We do want to send out a special greeting to our host, Jim Christina, who's not able to be with us tonight, but we know he's listening, also social distancing in Idaho. So, Jim, we love you and we miss you and we hope you enjoy tonight's show. So let me get right into it because we're very excited to have this guest with us tonight, and she has so much to share. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest, Peggy Jaker. She writes contemporary romances about strong women, the families who support them, and the men who can't live without them. Family and food played huge roles in Peggy's stories because she believes there's nothing that holds a family structure together like sharing a meal or two or 10. And did we eat in this book? Dotted with humor and characters that are as real as they are loving, Peggy brings all aspects of life into her stories: life, death, sibling rivalry, illness, and the desire for everyone to find their own happily ever after. Growing up the only child of divorced parents, she longs for sisters, brothers, and a family that vowed to stick together no matter what came their way. And through her books, she has created the family she wanted as that lonely child. Tonight, we are speaking about one of her newest titles, A Pride of Brothers, Rick. And please welcome Peggy Jaker. Welcome, Peggy.
Thank you so much, Bobby. I'm so honored to be here, and I hope I can live up to that build-up. I mean, I know that that's my bio, but sometimes even when I hear it, I'm like, who are they talking about?
Well, I have no doubt that you're going to, that you are. Let me just go ahead and why don't you just tell us a little bit about this book, and then we're going to ask Richard to ask you a question. So go ahead and tell us about this book.
Okay, well, it's the first in the series of three books. It's my first foray into what I call romantic suspense light. It's not really, you know, international intrigue or drug cartels or anything, but there is an element of suspense in it. At the heart of it, though, it's a romance book about two wounded people who never thought they'd find love and surprisingly found each other. I like to write about people that have been fractured, and both of these souls, Abby Lane and Rick Bannerman, have really pretty lousy pasts, but they've managed to make their presence really good and productive, and they're wonderful members of society. But they're kind of like oil and, I was going to say oil and vinegar, but you want oil and vinegar to mix. They're kind of like oil and water in a lot of ways, but in the end, they find out that they're better suited for their differences because their differences make them suited for each other. So that's it in a nutshell.
And it's filled with really interesting characters. Richard, take it away.
Well, brace yourself, folks. Here we go. It was an interesting book to read. You know, I'm not a romance reader, but you did a very good job of building up the tension between the two characters, letting them get a little closer each time until, you know, they finally decided to go ahead and take that next step. But the thing that caught me was the way you dropped these little nuggets about each of them so that we understood a little bit more about why they were reacting the way they were. And it's something that I appreciated because you don't want to do the data dump.
Oh, God, I hate backstory. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. So you want to blend it in carefully. How long did it take you to kind of develop what you wanted to do with the characters and what their backstories were before you even sat down and wrote your first word?
Okay, well, for a little bit of backstory on me, it's not an info dump, but it does help you understand how I write. I am a registered nurse by profession, so I have a background in the scientific method. I never approach anything without having it fully thought out and plotted. Even when I write, like, my blog, I always make bullet points about what I want to say so that I'm not a good writer by the seat of my pants. I'm a total plotter. So before I ever wrote this down, I gave a lot of consideration to why two people that are so different would find their differences good for each other. Now, the one way that Rick is, he always uses his self-deprecating humor, and Abby's more serious. Well, she brings out the serious in him, and he brings out the fun in her. So it's that oil and water mixture that I really find interesting. So I give a lot of thought to it. It took me about a month to plot it out, and then I write every day for between 8 and 10 hours. So it took me about less than 3 months to get the first draft under my belt.
Are the characters based on anybody that you know? Because I mean, there's a lot of depth to what's going on with both of them as far as, you know, their past. They both were in a way abused in the past in different ways. Rick more physically, Abby more mentally and emotionally.
They're not based on anybody in my real life or anybody I know, but they are, again, being a nurse, I saw the best and the worst of humanity for many years. So they're composites of people.
Well, they're really well developed, and it helped getting into the story when you had that depth to them where you, as like I said, you kept dropping these little nuggets about their backgrounds or a thought of why Rick didn't want to get into a long-term relationship, things like that, that, you know, in the grand scheme of things aren't the most important thing in the world, but it's those little things that you add to your character that make them more believable and you connect with. And I thought you did a really good job with that in this book.
Well, thank you. That's a really high compliment coming from anybody. Any writer wants to know that they've been able to fully develop a character to the point where the reader can connect with them. And so I'm the first person to connect with these people. So if I don't connect with them, I can't imagine anybody else would either. So that's why I give like a lot of thought to their backstory in my plotting. I don't necessarily use every single thing I come up with, because that would just be a big info dump. But I do try to incorporate into like dialogue why somebody's motivation is the way they are. So thank you for that. That's a nice compliment to hear. And it makes me know that I did my job.
Oh, yeah.
There's another kind of damaged character in this book. I'm really not necessarily a cat lover, but I did fall in love with Moonlight. Tell us a little bit about Moonlight and the role that she plays in this book.
Well, and in all honesty, she's like the bridge between Rick and Abby. She is also damaged. She is a three-legged cat who was, you know, abandoned at a shelter. And when Abby decided she wanted to get a pet, she, of course, went to a shelter. And she saw this cat, and she knew that nobody was going to want this cat. Even the people at the shelter said, you know, we've had this cat for a while. She was injured in a car accident. Nobody wants it because they think she's damaged. And I think damaged people seek out other damaged people because there's a kinship there. So Abby is the type of person that she doesn't feel anybody will ever love her. So she thought the cat might feel the same way. If, you know, if you're going to put human emotions on a cat, she kind of thought the cat would be the same way. So she found a kindred spirit. And Moonlight is truthfully, in my opinion, when I wrote that character in there, a bridge between Abby and Rick, because in what she does, I don't want to give the plot away, but there's a major plot point with the cat at the end. In what she does, she really fosters the relationship between the two of them. And it made me feel good that I was able to do that.
Well, and you give her a lot of characteristics, just how she eats and noises yep. that she makes and how she purrs and yes, and how she interacts with them. That I thought that she added a lot of, I could certainly see how she was being used as a bridge. She was a lot of fun.
Thank
you. Did you catch all that about Moonlight, Richard?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I picked up on the fact that she's a typical cat. She actually owns the house. She's just letting the rest of us live in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
correct,
you're just
correct.
And so, there are some other fun things about food. And I know in the intro you talk about food, and both of these characters approach food somewhat differently. Food plays
They're opposites. Yes.
Yeah. Food plays another important role. And there's a sister very connected to food. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I wrote a series of three books for Kensington Publishers several years ago called The Will Cook for Love series. I mean, it's a corny title, but the main character in that series was Abby Lane's eldest sister, Candy, who happens to be like a Food Network star. So Candy, as the oldest of seven sisters, was the sister who took care of all of the her siblings. And the way she takes care of everybody is through food. That's how she shows her love. So again, going with a backstory, people aren't perfect. And I came from divorced parents, and the Lane sisters came from divorced parents, and they've each dealt with their parents' divorce in a different way. Abby, you know, used food. So because her sister, Candy, the food celebrity, shows her love through food, it became kind of a yin and yang between the two of them. So, you know, in the book, when you read The Pride of Brothers, you see a lot of why Abby is so controlling, because she knows if she loses control, you know, her weight starts to gain and she feels bad about herself. So it's a way of maintaining control, but also her sister recognizes that and gives her, you know, good food and always fosters good eating habits. And Abby tries to do that with Rick, who believes junk food is part of the food pyramid. So it's difficult when you have two characters that have totally different feelings about food. So that's how that came about.
Well, preach on, Brother Rick, on that point.
I know, that's like my husband. My husband believes junk food is a food category too. So it's interesting.
Definitely.
I know I wanted to eat a lot of the things they were eating. It just, you made everything sound so delicious at Abby's place.
Thank you. And the funny thing is, I'm a big cook. So when I wrote that original series, the Will Cook for Love series, all the recipes that I mentioned in each of those books are my tried and true recipes. And in this book too, all the stuff that Candy made, I've made several thousand times. So I know what they taste like. I know what they smell like. I can give good descriptions for them.
Richard, did you also catch on the underwear and the and the high-heeled shoes? And they go right along with food. I don't know.
They do, yes. apparently, I need to clue everybody in on the fact that I, A, am a guy, B, I'm a sci-fi guy. So, C, I didn't linger on those sections of the book over long. But I did pick up on that. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Another facet of that, if you want to talk about the shoes in part, having had a weight problem my entire life, the one thing I know is no matter how big or how skinny you are, a good pair of shoes always makes a girl feel good. So that was another motivator for Abby.
Well, and with that thought, let me see if I can just get Ronan's attention. And Ronan, if you could we hear a little bit about LA Talk Radio?
Hey there, J. Michael here for LA Talk Radio. And you know, while you're on furlough or just plain staying home because of the coronavirus, if you're working at home, what better way to pass your day than to tune in to www.latalkradio.com and listen to some of our fine broadcasting during the day. We have a lot to offer. We have a lot on the air, so give us a listen. Right now, we've got one of your favorites. LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block, and it's coming at you right now. So kick back, relax, and enjoy.
That's a great commercial.
Yeah, we're so grateful for being on LA Talk Radio 5 years in two weeks now, Richard, I think.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
So we've made some references to things like underwear and such. And when you and I chatted the other night, I said, you know, I'm an older gal, and And I have to say that I found my heart beating quickly, and I found myself squirming in my seat at times. And I thought, oh my gosh, was it like this? And then I thought, you know, maybe I'll ask Peggy to talk a little bit about writing steamy scenes, and just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'll tell you quickly. I live in a very small New England town. And if you know anything about New England Yankees, they're very stoic and they don't suffer fools. And, you know, most of them, I think they were hatched and their parents didn't have sex. So writing these scenes for me was a little bit cathartic in essence. Every writer that does a steamy scene will probably tell you that at some point it's uncomfortable. But the thing that I always have to remember, and the thing that's been really, that has helped me, because I do write a lot of romantic love scenes. I don't want to call them sex scenes because they're not. They're more like love scenes where the people are actually expressing themselves physically, their love physically. But what we try to remember when you write romance like that is that it's not the physicality that's important. It's the emotion behind it. So, you know, in different kinds, categories of romance, I write every category. I've written from sweet romance, where there's nothing but a simple kiss and you can't have any body parts throbbing or hardening or anything else, to steamy, which is what I would consider A Pride of Brothers is, because there's a couple of different love scenes in it. But when you think about what the characters are doing on the page, you don't want to make the reader uncomfortable. You want to make the reader, you know, bring them into the scene, bring them into the emotions that are being portrayed. Yes, somebody may be touching a body part, or, you know, something may be throbbing, but why is it throbbing? Why are they touching that body part? What kind of an emotional response does it elicit? So for me, that's, I don't want to say it's fun, but that's the best word for it. It is fun coming up with ways where I can, you know, you can only use so much terminology for body parts. So you have to come up with different ways to call a spade, you know. So, but I actually do enjoy writing them. And I have what are called slow burn books, which means most of my characters that do become intimate don't become intimate until more than half the book is over. Yes, they may fool around a little bit. They may kiss and grope around, or like the kids say, make out a little bit, but they don't have a consummated relationship until way, you know, towards the midline of the book, and because that's called slow burn. Because I like the anticipation. Mm-hmm. I like that moment right before a kiss, not a kiss, but right before a kiss, when the breaths are mingling, when you're staring at each other, when you can actually see somebody's heart beating in their temple. That to me is more stimulating than the actual act of writing it. So that's the reason, you know, behind that. So if you were squirming in your seat, I'm hoping you were squirming, you know, in anticipation, not in like uncomfortableness.
No, in anticipation. I wonder, and then Richard, I'm going to turn it back to you. I have just one more question on this. When you are putting the book together, and when you spent that month of sort of plotting it, these two characters, you know, there's a very sort of a slow burn teaser kind of, it opens way.
Yes.
And then we meet them 4 years later, and then we have the book and you take us through. There were a number of scenes. How do you determine when you go back to edit, do you edit out something and go, you know, I really don't need another scene like that one. This, you know,
yes.
Tell me a little bit about how you know when you've got the right amount of
part of that part. Yeah, that's a great, that's an absolutely fabulous question. Part of that is having a really good editor. And my editor at the Wild Rose Press, the publisher of this book, is a fabulous editor. She's one of those people that will, you know, hone in and say, you've said this three times. And you know, sometimes I don't even realize I use the same phrase because I've said it so often in my head. But when I plot out a book, I usually plot a book at about 20 to 22 chapters. And my books always end up with about 19 or 20. So that tells you I take a certain amount out. After a while, putting in one more intimate scene is just boring. People are going to, like Richard said, they're going to skim right over it. So, you know, you have to know what the direct balance is. And I've read books where, you know, the story started out great, And then in the middle, you know, they have a relationship. And then the rest of the book is just them having a relationship.
Uh-huh.
There's no growth. There's no conflict. You know, they're happily ever after comes on page 200 of a 400-page book.
Right.
And I never want to write that. So if I find myself after I've written the book, when I go back and I read my first draft, if I say, you know what, this isn't really adding anything to the story, it's just one more scene, then I'll take it out. And I'm a really good self-editor. I like... You know, I like writing and I like taking the words out. A lot of writers don't. A lot of writers, you know, they want to hang on to every single right word they've put in that book. Not me. I want it to be the best book it can possibly be. And like I said, my editor at Wild Rose Press is amazing at helping me do that, too.
Mm-hmm. That's a great answer. Richard, on to you. What you got to ask?
Well, I'm just going to jump on the editing point mm-hmm. real quick. The relationship between the writer, whether you're writing fiction or, in my case, the newspaper days, and the editor, it shouldn't be a knockdown, drag-out brawl between the two. It should be a collaboration. And it sounds like you and your editor are collaborating. And fortunately for me, I have an editor who's the same way. I can send her my script, and she's going to come back with, you know, comments and changes and whatnot. And I can trust that she's doing for my book to make it better than it was when I, you know, before I sent it to her. So you have to have that relationship with a good editor.
I agree 100%.
The one thing I wanted, there's a theme that's kind of running through the book. And I wonder if you meant to do this or if it just developed, but the characters, the two main characters are people who are their present day adult person is really been set up and built based on the experiences they had as children with the abusive situations they were in. And I was wondering, is that a theme that you wanted to develop where all the things good or bad that happened to us in our childhood have a great impact on us when we're older adults, whether we realize that or not?
No, 100%. All my books are like that. There's also a very prominent theme in many of the books that I write about forgiveness, self-forgiveness, forgiveness for your parents, you know, because all of our parents screwed us up. I probably screwed up my daughter too. I mean, you know, there's no manual that tells you how to be the best parent. And everybody's childhood impacts their adulthood. But what makes the difference is how you respond to that. So like I said, I came from divorced parents. I was the type of girl, I was never going to get married ever. And I said that my entire life. And then I met the most wonderful man in the entire world that turned my whole mind around about that. But my youth and the experiences I had in my childhood did form that kind of a thought in my head. So with my characters, all of them, in every book, I think I've got 19 or 20 books now, every single one of those books, there's a theme running through them, and some of them are more overt than others, that how we were as children, the experiences that we went through, the love we did or didn't receive, will have an impact on the type of human being you become as an adult. And you have the choice to let it affect you negatively or positively. And I truthfully believe that. My background is in psych nursing, and I've seen a lot of people that were destroyed because they didn't know how to take what they learned as children, the problems that they had as children, and make it better for themselves as adults. Like, they repeated vicious cycles, and yeah, they didn't know how to come out of those cycles. So I'm a very big believer in that. And like I said, my background in psych has helped me be able to understand that in characterizations.
Well, with Rick, we see he was a victim of physical abuse, and he witnessed
Correct.
This physical abuse on his mother as well. And that
Correct.
Drove him to become a kind of a warrior protector figure.
Yep.
But
yep.
it also led him to think, well, if my father is this way, I'm going to be this way. So I'm going to stop the cycle now by not even getting involved and having kids. And you kind of walked us through him growing past that and understanding you don't have to go to that extreme to end the cycle.
Right.
By him just making that decision that I'm not going to do what my father did, he's already broken the cycle.
Correct. And they just didn't realize it. The thing that, you know, another thing that always runs in through my mind, my grandmother used to say to me, DNA will always out. And that used to bother me a lot because it takes the choice away from you. You know, you could have been raised in a horrible situation, but there's many people that have been raised in horrible situations that have gone on to run Fortune 500 companies and mm-hmm. who are peacemakers in the world. It really is how you use how you were raised, how you take what happened to you and make it better. And that's what I wanted to show for Rick and for Abby, because Abby was very untrusting of men for the same reason. You know, she saw her mother destroyed and left penniless, and that has a big impact on her life. She wants to defend women who are left with no choices. It's the reason why she adopted a three-legged cat. Same thing. She wants to stand up for the defenseless. And, you know, in each way, both of these characters are warriors. They just come at it from different viewpoints.
Yeah. Now, you brought up her mother, Hannah, and there was an interesting aspect of their relationship that you reveal later in the book. And I thought mm-hmm. that made her and her mother's characters that much better, that you brought that out and let us know that this is what she was thinking and her mother was aware of this all this time.
Thank you for saying that. Again, that's a huge compliment because it makes me believe that I did my job. The relationship between children and parents is tenuous at best, even in the best of families. And in this character's family, there were seven sisters, and she was a single parent. So to be a single parent of seven daughters and be able to know what's going on in each of their lives, even though she wasn't around because she was working, is an amazing thing. And I think back to my own mother. My mother was a single parent for many years before she remarried. And even though she was gone a lot working, she was always present. And I don't think some parents get a lot of credit for being present. They may not be there physically, but they are present in your life. They know what's going on, and they do try to do their best. So again, it's about forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. There's interesting parallels as I think about the book that we have some side projects that they're mm-hmm. working on. We don't want to do any spoiler alerts, but we have a father, a husband and a wife and a young boy. And there's a lot of damage in that relationship for sure. And then we have a father and a son that get revealed later in the book that are not relatives. These are, you know, like parts of the plot, very important parts mm-hmm. of the plot that pull Abigail and Rick together. And mm-hmm. And so you're also demonstrating through those other two sort of parent and child relationships, you're showing us kids and potentially, you know, how they can be impacted.
Correct. And again, it sounds like, you know, when we talk about it this way, it sounds like the book is such a downer and it's so deep.
Oh, no.
It really is lighthearted in a lot of ways but you know, when you had read my bio, it says I like to use all aspects of life. Well, nobody's life is perfect all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's life is bad all the time. This is life and this is how we live it. So, you know, aspects of parents and children, writing about them is a lot of fun for me because I can really use a lot of what I learned in nursing and a lot of what I learned in my childhood, you know, and with people I know that have been through divorce to bring the characterizations to full life. So thank you again for all those compliments, because it makes me feel like I really did my job.
Well, we were talking about editing a few moments ago, and Richard and Jim Christina are the powers behind Tuscany Bay Books. Richard, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and if you first-time writers who are just about ready to put the end on that manuscript of yours thinks that you can now just sit back and count all those dump trucks full of $100 bills that are going to pull up to the front door, oh, honey, no, that's not happening yet. Because you've gotten, believe it or not, the easy part has just been done. Now the
Correct.
Hard work starts. You have to get your words, your books, into the hands of your readers. And that's how you're going to put money into your bank account. But in today's traditional publishing world, it's become harder and harder for first-time authors to land that contract and get their books on the shelves. Even when they do, get that contract. The majority of the marketing work is still left up to them, and they have better things to do. Rather than being a salesperson, they should be writing their next book. So Tuscany Bay and Black Dog Publishing has a better idea. They've launched a program to help new authors put their words to page, their book on a shelf, and make their dreams come true. They even offer access to an editor and a book cover creator, who's actually not too bad, if I do say so myself, at a very affordable rate for those authors who don't want to go through the process and expense of finding their own editor and cover artist. So contact them today for more information on how they can help you get on the path to becoming a happily published independent author. Use the submission form at TuscanyBayBooks.com, or you can email jchristina@TuscanyBayBooks.com for more information and get on the path to publishing success.
Thank you, Richard.
Not one bad these, since I haven't done that in 26 months.
I know. One of these days, I'm going to have to write a book.
Just so you can use their services.
Exactly. Exactly. Let's see, Peggy. Let's move a little bit away. We've talked a lot about how you write as we've discussed this book, but let's maybe talk a little bit about how you schedule. You said you work 8 to 10 hours a day. Why don't you talk a little bit about your writing schedule and how you go about planning your time?
Sure, that's easy for me. Well, first, you know, well, let's do a time limit here. I just turned 60 2 weeks ago, and I retired 5 years ago at the age of 55 when I got my very first book contract. I had a Cinderella story. I entered a contest. The contest I won, and then the publisher of the Wild Rose Press called me and said, you know, can I publish your book? So that was great. Since I retired, my husband was afraid that I was just going to sit around all day and maybe write every now and again, because I was used to being, you know, busy all day long. Mm-hmm. As you know, everybody that works outside the home and in the home, you're busy a lot. So I said to myself, to do this the right way, to make this a career, I'm going to approach it like it's a job, even though it's not a job. It's a total labor of love. So because I have chronic insomnia, I'm usually up at 3 o'clock every morning. And from 3 to 6, I usually do all my social media stuff. I write my blog. I publish my blog. I do all my alerts that I need to do for the day between, you know, BookBub and Twitter and Instagram. And I schedule them all. Then after my husband goes off to work, I exercise, because if you sit in a chair all day long, mm-hmm. your butt is going to get big. And I don't want my butt to get big. Mm-hmm. So I exercise for about an hour to an hour and a half. And then I sit down. So about 8 o'clock every morning, I start to really, really start writing. And I'm much better in the morning. I'm much fresher. So I usually write about 4 hours straight. Take a little break for lunch. Sometimes I'll go for a walk, or I'll watch the view or something. And then I'll write for about anywhere between 3.5 to 4.5 hours in the afternoon. I very rarely write anything new at night, because by then my brain really isn't as fresh as I'd like it to be. But what I do at night is I will read over some of the stuff I wrote during the day. And if I want to make any changes, I'll make myself a note. I never make the changes when I'm tired, because I don't know if they're actually really good changes, or I'm just doing mm-hmm. it because I'm tired. Mm-hmm. So then I read them the next morning. So yeah, I usually write anywhere between 8 and 10 hours a day. Now, on the weekends, I don't write as much. I usually write maybe 2 or 3 hours. On the weekends, I do a lot of editing. My husband still works every third weekend. So, you know, on those weekends, I may write a little bit more. But the weekends are really more for us to be together, because, you know, he works full time and then I work here. So that's what I usually do. And I am never without a notebook. So even if we go on vacation, or if we, you know, we travel in the car for several hours, I'm always making notations of things I want to write, or like a phrase will come to me and I'll write it down so I don't forget it. So that's basically my schedule. So it's treated like a job, even though it is my passion. And by doing that, I can usually write a first draft in less than 12 weeks. And that's proven time and again, because since I published my very first book, I had my very first book published in 2015. I've had 20 books. So it's 5 years. So that averages out between 3 and 4 books a year. Now, a couple of them are novellas. They're only about 40,000 words, but still, still a lot of work.
Yeah. So. So, Richard, I think we've opened up the perfect window for that question.
Oh, it is time to ask you, Peggy.
For that question.
Peggy Jaeger, what have you ever encountered that dreaded curse to all writers known as the writer's block? And if you have, whatever have you done to chase that foul beast away?
Okay. I really hope that anybody who's a writer and who is listening to this doesn't hate me. But uh-oh. I have never once in my entire life not been able to write. So, and I think the reason is, well, first of all, I approached this later in life. So I had 55 years of thinking up stories that I wanted to write down. But more importantly, I think it's because I'm a plotter. I'm the type of person that when I walk out of the house, I like to know where I'm going. I'm not the kind that ambles, and I don't like to go for, you know, a walk down the block and back just to kill time. I like to go someplace with an itinerary. So, like, I don't leave the house unless I have to go somewhere, like the store, grocery shopping, stuff like that. Yeah. I approach writing the same way. I never sit down to write without knowing what it is that I want to write. And that usually means that, you know, every single day that I write, I get between 33,000 and 4,000 words a day. You know, I may not keep them all in editing, but I still produce them. So I can't ever tell you that I have a cure for writer's block. I did hear Nora Roberts once say that if you think you have writer's block, don't move. Stay at the computer and write something, even if it's a letter. Because when your brain goes to something else, like if you couldn't write a plot point and you think about something else, your brain will still work on that plot point and it may come to you, which is why a lot of people wake up in the middle of the night having solved something because their quiet brain is working on it. Mm-hmm. So that's the only advice I would ever have. But I'm sorry to anybody else that has that. I have never had it. And I'm telling you, I honestly think it's because I'm a plotter.
Well, don't worry about people hating you, because the first time I was on this show, I got asked that question by Russ Avison. And my answer was fairly similar. I've never been hit with it either, but I also had about a 25-30 year career as a newspaper writer before I started doing novels. So I had that 25-30 years of you had to write something every day anyway. So
you had a deadline.
You couldn't afford to get writer's block. So I built up an immunity over that time stretch. You know, I heard one author, it was on this show, and I am drawing a blank on who said it, was that they didn't get writer's block so much as they got writer's exhaustion, because they had so many ideas that they just couldn't get dialed in on the one they wanted to work on. And they would just stop and back off for a minute, go do one little thing for however long it took, and then come back and start again. They didn't go away for a long time, but I can see writer's exhaustion more than writer's block.
And, you know, I think that's a valid thing. And I still think it goes back to plotting. There are so many of my writer friends are pantsers. Those are the people that write by the seat of their pants. They have a core idea in their head, but they don't do the actual writing and planning until they sit down to write. So they can write a chapter right from their, you know, their brain. I tried to do that once and I literally got a stomach ache. So because I was like, I don't know where this is going. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't know what they're supposed to say. So being able to sit it down and even if I just bullet point it out, even if it's just that, and I do that every night before I close up my computer in the afternoon, I do make a couple of bullet points about where I want to go next, even though it's plotted out. I put the bullet points in and the next morning when I start writing, I don't stop.
You know, to follow up on a point, you said you came at this later in life, and it's something that as I was reading your bio yesterday, one of my favorite authors is Jack McDivitt. He didn't start writing novels till he was 46. And I think that's about the same age that I decided I was done with newspapers. It was time to go back to doing novels and fiction. Do you find that maybe by coming at novel writing later in life, like we have, that it has made you not only a better writer, but it gives you the ability to create more in-depth characters that you can bring things in and give to these characters traits you have or traits you've noticed from other people. And it builds these characters up to be much better than they would have been had you attacked this story at the age of 20.
100%. In fact, I read a book about a year and a half ago. It was a new author to me, and I think it was like her second book. And she was writing about a military widow. So the woman she was writing about was in her 40s, and it wasn't a romance. It was a woman's fiction type of a book. The woman was in her 40s, and as I'm reading the book, the introspection and that the woman is having on her life didn't ring true to me at all. And then I went and I found the author's bio. She was like 21 years old.
Yeah.
I was like, she hasn't walked the walk. She has no idea, you know, what a 40-something widowed woman is going to think. And she hadn't done her research, because if she had gone out and found people, found women who were military widows in their 40s, she would have found out that, you know, this didn't ring true. And it was surprising to me because it was a traditionally published book. It wasn't an indie book. It was actually, you know, a publishing house thought it was good enough to write, to publish. And I had to give up on it, because when a character doesn't ring true to me, it just wrecks the whole book. Mm-hmm. So yeah. What you're saying, Jim, what you're saying, Richard, is 100%. It's 100% true. The more life experiences you have and approaching it as an older person really makes you appreciate how much depth you can put into a character.
I have a question about, just real quick. In our interviewing so many authors over the years, we've often heard authors say, well, I planned my character to do this or that, but the character would not let me do that. And the character, you know, Richard, we've heard this so often. And when I listen to how you really have such firm control over the plotting and such, do your characters ever surprise you and take you some way you were not planning to go? No?
No, not at all. And I think the word that you use, control, is the reason why. Again, when I hear my friends say that too, I have writer friends who say that, and I think, that's great for you, but it makes me wonder, did you really think the character through? Because, you know, when I sit down to write a character arc, I have my whole backstory. I don't put a word on the page until I know these people like they were my best friends growing up. So I really wonder sometimes when that happens if people haven't thought the character arc through. Now, one thing that I have heard people say that does resonate with me, it's never happened, but sometimes they'll say a secondary character wants to take over. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's good, because that's your next book then.
Yeah.
Just, you know, what's your next book? Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I need to have you have a word with Little John Singapore. He's a character in a series I'm writing. And that little monster has taken over the series. And I can't get it back
book.
From him. He's got six. So
okay.
There you go.
This is there a great time to take a quick Ronan, if you could go ahead and let's hear a little bit about Creative Edge.
You know, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. No. They work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals and needs. So Creative Edge, it's your brand and your future. Mickey Mickelson, publicist, www.creative-edge.com. Dot services.
And that was a note about Creative Edge, one of our sponsors. We thank them so very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me think. I had a question. It's just gone. Richard, did you have? Oh my goodness! I had it, and I didn't write it. Didn't write it down. See what happened.
I hate it when that happens. I had that happen during a show, and I don't know where I wound up wandering off to. But Jim's across the table, going, "What are you doing?" Okay, so the one question I had left in my arsenal here was the title. Lends us to believe that this is the first of a series, Pride of Brothers.
Is
it going to be the same characters, or are we going to switch to a completely new set of characters in the next book?
Okay, so the private detective agency that Rick works for is called Brothers, Inc. It's run by his best friend, Josh, and Josh's two brothers and brother-in-law also work there. Now, the brother-in-law has already had his own story. He was part of the Will Cook for Love series. So I have two of Josh's brothers left. You could call them Rick's, you know, adoptive brothers. I have two of them left. So, yes, they will have new heroes and new heroines, but all along the same, you know, subtly dangerous aspect. So, again, romantic suspense light.
So we're going to hear more about Abby and Rick in this series, or are they off doing what they're doing?
Well, you'll hear them mentioned. You know, they won't be total characters. They'll be like walk-ons. But you know, I have two brothers left. I have Aiden and Dylan. So those are their two. It'll be a Pride of Brothers Dylan and a Pride of Brothers Aiden, and then we'll see what happens after that.
And that was the question I had. I just found it on my list. I can put a check mark off to it.
I stole your question. That's okay, Bobby.
Peggy,
I was going to say the thing about romance writers is we always like to write in series.
Mm-hmm.
We do. We like to introduce new people in each book that, you know, a bunch of brothers, a bunch of sisters, a bunch of cousins, a bunch of friends, so that they're all related. So God, that's what I wanted to say. Ben, what were you going to ask me?
Well, I was going to say, when you gave us your schedule, I didn't hear much time open for things like reading. Do you like to read? And if you do, what do you like to read?
Okay, so I read on average 3 to 4 books a week. And I read at night when after dinner, when it's wind down time. Like I said, I can't write fresh in the evening because my brain has been awake for so long, but I can read. And I love to read lots of stuff. I love to read biographies. I love biographies of strong women. Mm-hmm. Some of my favorite biographies that I've ever read have been like of Eleanor Roosevelt. I've read all the first ladies' biographies. I'm not that great about celebrities because I don't think they really make much of an impact on the world. I like to read romance. Obviously, I like to write it, but I read and I love Regency or historical romances. I don't write them, though, because they have so many rules that I know that I would make a mistake and I'd have readers hate me. So it's better for me to write contemporary because I know about the here and now. But I love reading. In fact, I'm reading one of Lorraine Heath's books right now. It's called A Duke Takes a Fancy or Fancy to a Duke, something like that. Anyway, I love reading about, you know, dangerous dukes and lusty lords. I just love it.
I love
a good suspense. I mean, Michael Palmer, before he died, was one of my favorite writers. I love Nora Roberts, and I love her doppelganger, J.D. Robb. Nora Roberts writes under J.D. Robb, and she writes a police procedural set in the future, and it's really amazing. So, I mean, those are the kind of things. But I do read on average 3 to 4 books a week because I read very fast and I read at night. So I love it.
So I know a lot of our listeners are going to want to read you. So why don't you tell us where they can find you, follow you, and so forth?
Okay, well, that's easy. Because I am a certain age and I am very forgetful, I didn't want to have 67 different, you know, website things that I couldn't remember. So it's very easy. My website is peggyjager.com. You can find me on Twitter on Peggy Jager. My Facebook page is Peggy Jager, author. My Instagram page is the same. And under BookBub, I'm Peggy Jager, author too. I'm also on Goodreads, same thing. And all my books are available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, mostly, you know, online. Romance doesn't, you know, I'm not in the stratosphere of romance writers that I'm going to be sent to major bookstores, but you can get everything online.
Mm-hmm.
So Amazon, BookBub, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, iTunes, all those places.
And actually, Out West Shop now is an affiliate to bookshop.org.
Correct.
And I put your book up last night on the Out West Shop.
Thank you.
Affiliate. And tonight I'll put in the link to today's podcast. So Richard, do you have one last question before we let Peggy go have something to eat? Or I guess it's like 11 o'clock your time now, Peggy.
It's 11 o'clock my time. Yeah, it's almost time for me to go to sleep for an hour.
I was going to say, you know, being up in New Hampshire, I know you're an hour ahead of me. And I'm already ready to call it a day, but listening to your schedule as you laid it out is exhausting. You wear me out just trying to keep up with your schedule. What you're doing, how you fit all that into one day amazes me. So,
I can totally blame it on menopause-induced insomnia. It really is. That's the major reason.
We'll do that. But I am very glad we had a chance to talk with you tonight.
Thank you.
Oh, it was lovely talking to the both of you, too. I'm so honored. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Peggy. And just keep writing because we want to keep reading.
Yeah. I had a book come out in May. I've got another one coming out on July 1st, so I'm doing good.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Well, we so appreciate giving us your time so late this evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here. And yay to all your listeners. You guys are wonderful.
Richard, next week we have Andrea Downing on the show, and her book is Always on My Mind, and I believe this will be with Russ Avison, unless I hear differently. So Russ will be in the captain's chair next week. And once again, we just miss Jim Christina, and we look forward to having him back.
Oh, yes,
and
definitely.
So I'm just going to close this up and say until next week to our author friends, keep writing and we'll keep reading. And thank you to all our listeners. We are out of here.